welcome to another edition of the Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppins, and unfortunately, Kathleen can't be with us today. Well, this is going to be therefore a somewhat lonely reminiscing of the last few weeks and what has been happening. And I'm spending these last few days in London meeting up with Duncan Rhodes, the editor-in-chief of Nexus magazine, and we have been enjoying the wonderful weather which London currently has experiencing. In fact, the warmest days at the end of March on record. And when you look up in the sky, you see the beautiful Jupiter and Venus and the Moon, and also at this moment in time, Orion and Sirius. And just a few minutes before actually coming down to do this show, we were just looking at this magnificent sky, which is so prominent and so dominating, and has been accompanying Kathleen and I over the last few weeks as we were spending time in England, Scotland, and specifically the south of France. And an awful lot of things have been happening with us, but also in the world, as the world approaches December 21st, 2012. And this is a very interesting time, because Kathleen's birthday was March 22nd, but March 21st was, of course, the spring equinox, 9 months to go before that ominous or hopeful day of December 21st, when the sun and the solar system and the entire galactic alignment, so to speak, of how the sun and the earth and the center of the galaxy really align. And it's a wonderful time to realize that so many interesting astronomical phenomena are happening as we speak. It was the first time in an awful long period of time, I think 25 years, and the next one is in another 25 years from now, that on March 21st you had the spring equinox and the new moon. And then, of course, there is the Venus transit, which is famous and is being talked about, happening in June at the moment of the summer solstice. And then, of course, December 21st itself. So all of these things really making 2012 a very important year, from the way the stars seem to be conspiring or underlining that we are living in interesting times. And that is definitely the case. Kathleen and I have been living a lifestyle whereby we have been told that we are very blessed, and we are indeed blessed, and we meet so many beautiful people along the way. And one of the reasons why we were in the south of France was because we were doing our first week-long writing seminar called The Writer's Grail. And what we have there are basically a group of 20 to 25 people who are trying to better their writing, but specifically have the knowledge that within them is a book, and some of them aspire to become professional writers because they feel that they can do so. And that's definitely the case, and we give them pointers as to what to do and what specifically not to do, the lay of the land of the publishing world, and all of these things. But what we always find interesting is that people are embracing this idea. People go out of their comfort zone. They leave the States or Australia behind them, quite often for unknown territory, a very small village somewhere in the south of France, and to some extent trust their fate on the capabilities of Kathleen and I and the rest of the tour organization to feed them, to take them from A to B, and deliver what they are basically told they are going to get. But for an awful lot of people, that this is an important step. It is not just about traveling to a foreign country, but it is also about stepping into the shoes of somebody who they want to become. They realize that for years they have had this urge, this yearning, this calling, this mission to become a writer, and they finally take the decision to step into those shoes and head that call and really come to, in this case, us. But obviously we are just one of several of these facilitators who do this. Of course we're far better than anybody else, but we are there to help these people in realizing their dreams. And it is great to see that everybody in 2012 is definitely committed to stepping into shoes and trying to find out whether the new shoes fit them better, and bringing about radical change. Quite often in challenging times, some of these, I'm finding that an awful lot of people are challenged with family issues, whether it is deaths in the family or very ill people, and it takes some guts to sometimes stand up and say, no, I have to do this. I have to do this for my own self. And so that is something which we're definitely seeing, this kind of transitioning effect of people wanting to do new things, people who are unhappy with the old ways of living their lives and basically trying to do something. And of course, not everybody should or can or needs to become a writer, but when we hear the other people talk and various other stories, we see how this really is bringing about a new wave. And the village of Montségur is one of those southern French villages which is really of interest, because what we have in places like Rennes-le-Château, Montségur, and Bougarach are really villages which have between 30 and 100 people living there. The house numbers in Montségur are, or rather the houses in Montségur don't have any street names, they just have house numbers. You live in number 10, the village. You live in number 115, the village. You don't live in a specific street because it is deemed to be basically too small to have street names. All of these places, Rennes-le-Château, Montségur, Bougarach, are being challenged in ways that really is of interest, whereby you have, you know, the case of Rennes-le-Château, which per year has between about 100,000 and 180,000 visitors, largely to do with the fact that this is a place of mystery which has been made prominent as such from the early 1980s onwards, and in recent times, of course, because of the Da Vinci Codes and, of course, also Kathleen's books. But this is a very interesting village, and we have always realized that whenever we are there, there are amazing synchronicities. People come out of nowhere, and a story which we lived most recently was how a young woman had left Italy behind, and she moved to Avignon because she had been attracted to the area of the south of France by reading Kathleen's books. And she settled down, she found a job, but she had never actually gone to Rennes-le-Château or Montségur because the job, day-to-day living, had really taken over. It's once again this classic standoff between the traditional world and your calling. And even though she had left Italy, her adopted home country, and settled in France, actually that full commitment of kind of like exploring there hadn't happened, and it simply hadn't happened because life is there, ordinary life, finding an income, finding a job, doing the dishes, cooking food, taking care of the car, all of these things. And so one day in October she decided that she was going to take the day off. She had She was clearing her agenda. She just woke up and realized that she just had to do this. And what she had to do was to go to Montségur. The weather was great. She goes to Montségur. She finds it bathing in sunshine. She lies on the walls of the castle. She's enjoying herself. And then she has this notion in her head, this voice, not necessarily a voice, but definitely a calling of saying, get off this mountain, go to Rennes-le-Château, you need to go to Rennes-le-Château. So she not necessarily runs off the mountain, but definitely gets off there as fast as she can, jumps in her car, drives to Rennes-le-Château, walks into the local bookshop there, gets talking to Helen and Cleely, who run that beautiful bookshop with so much love, and they basically ask, why are you here? And it's because of the books of Kathleen McGowan. And I think it was Helen, who was managing the shop, basically says, well, Kathleen is in the garden. She is, we were there with our October Sacred Friends group, and even though the garden was closed that day, Toby and Gerda, who managed that garden with so much love, had opened it specifically for our group. And so we were in the garden, and Laura came in there, and realized that this voice in her head was guiding her to finally meet the person who had been instrumental in getting her into her new life. And ever since October, Laura is experiencing these same emotions of embracing the fact that she lives in France now, and you know, should basically step into her mission. And so many people are doing that. But back to the Montségur issue and these small villages. Just earlier today, I was contacted by a Belgian newspaper because once again the story of Bougarache Mountain is hitting the newspaper. And here we are. We are in 2012. So many beautiful things are happening, and yet there is this nagging thing in the back of everybody's mind, which is definitely hitting the media, that 2012 should be all about doom and gloom and you know, a sad future for mankind. And in France, this is being typified by what is really happening within the community of Bougarache. And Bougarache is a big mountain. It's very prominent. When you're in Rennes-le-Château, you basically see two big mountains. One of them is Pêche Cardu, this conical hill, and then a bit further to the south, but in the same general horizon, is the Bougarache. And Bougarache is a hill which is almost 4,000 feet tall. In fact, it might be 4,000 feet. It's very prominent, and it comes with an awful lot of local lore. For example, in the 1980s, a relatively mysterious death occurred there. The story of Daniel Batex is one of those stories which has defied belief, in the sense that Daniel Batex was a Swiss person, Swiss-educated man, who was in charge of air traffic control for, I believe, Zurich Airport. And he spent his summer holidays in the south of France, and he was interested in the Cathars, and he made contact with the local Cathar organization, which was led by Theodore Rocher, by sometimes referred to as a Cathar Pope, a man who really put Catharism back on the map by a series of publications, and his trusted secretary, a woman called Lucienne Julien. And Daniel Batex approached those two and said, look, you know, I want to help explore how can I help this organization of Cathar studies. And Lucien basically said, well, you know, the Bougarache Castle is something which has some potential links with Catharism. We have nobody investigating there or researching its history. So if you want to, by all accounts, do so. And please feel to do so, and then report back or ask us for help if you need any. And so for a number of years, Batex spent his summer holidays there, until one summer when he was once again there. And after a few weeks on the field, he basically came to Lucienne Julien very excited, telling her that he had made a tremendous discovery, that within days he was going to come back to her and they would be, you know, heir to a secret and to the answer to a mystery which was beyond anybody's wildest expectations. And so he dashed off again, and a few days went by, and Batex wasn't heard of. And the next thing we heard was that Batex basically had died. His body had been found very much dehydrated, far more so than would be expected, and also in somewhat strange surroundings, in the sense that it seemed that he had been underground and somehow had been able to get to the surface and then had died, and as I said, was dehydrated. Anyway, an awful lot of stories have come about there. Some people in Bougarache will say that he was found in their garden. If so, he was found in several gardens. Other people will say that, you know, he found the Ark of the Covenant. Other people will say that he found even more important relics. Some people say that there are hidden UFO bases underneath Bougarache. But basically, ever since the 1980s, Bougarache has had this mystery atmosphere about itself. And in coming up to 2012, what happened was that a local guy wrote a series of pamphlets in which he sees Bougarache as a very important mountain, as somehow a mountain which is going to be immune to everything which is going to happen, you know, the catastrophes which are awaiting us at the end of this year. And basically all of these things are to be taken with tremendous amounts of salt. But it is a fact that there was this local cottage industry which somehow set Bucharest apart as a haven of salvation. And what happened next was that the local mayor decided to blow this all out of proportion and began to make this story up that somehow his little village was under assailment, that there was almost a siege by foreigners who were trying to come there because they were trying to be sure that by December 2012 they were going to survive the apocalypse which was going to happen, and he was railing against this. Now the interesting thing there is that what happens in France is that in the 1990s there was a series of collective suicides known as the Order of the Solar Temple, and even though I say collective suicides, it's actually clear that the members of this organization were all murdered by two individuals, two ex-policemen, and then basically, it was ruled to be a mass suicide, but really the evidence suggests that this was a mass killing, and I've written a few articles on them. It's really too political and too detailed to go into now, but they have been published in Access, and they are available for free on my website, so philipcoppens.com if you want to read them. But basically, because of these mass suicides and the enormous amount of media attention which happened to fall on this region in the 1990s, French voted into law very austere laws to do with sects, and very much anything which isn't the Catholic Church is on a watch list of cultish behavior, and it sometimes takes extreme forms. For example, Montségur is obviously a Cathar castle. It's linked with Catharism. It's where in 1244 220 perfects of the Cathar religion surrendered, and for readers of Kathleen's book, they will obviously know that this was a holding place of the Book of Love. It was smuggled out just before 16th of March 1244 and taken to safety. So with what Déodat Rocher was doing from the 1920s and 30s onwards, promoting Catharism as this real religion rather than this weird heresy which very few people knew about, Catharism really came back on the map. And so people come to Montségur not just because it is a very impressive and a very beautiful site, but also because it has extremely important significance and to some extent religious significance. And so what happens is that specifically New Age people will sometimes go to Montségur Castle and either sit in circles or hold hands or do some kind of commemoration service or some remembrance service whereby they honor the souls of those who died for believing in kind of like, and not recanting in light of the church who basically want them to recant. And the Cathars basically stuck to their guns and said, no, this is what we believe, and we are not afraid to die for our convictions. And that is, fortunately or unfortunately, what happened in 1244, and in fact for several decades leading up to 1244, because the Cathar Crusade took a number of decades and cost the lives of probably more than 1 million people throughout that region. So what happens today in Montségur is that an awful lot of people close their eyes and pray, and quite often what you have is local villagers running down the hill to the local hotel and say, you need to phone the police, you need to phone the police. And the local Heidi Ampère, who run the beautiful auberge de Montségur, ask their visitor, well, why? Why do I need to phone the police? And they say, well, there is a cult up the hill, and you need to phone them before they do something. And this is really the attitude of the French, I would say, modern man and woman, which is that, if you are religious, you practice religion in a church and nowhere else, and anywhere else where you close your eyes and pray, outside of a church or obviously like a cemetery or something to do immediately with religion, that is fine, but anywhere like a Cathar castle or anything else is really something which is off limits. And to a large extent, we've been reporting on this for a number of years, but Kathleen's struggle as to what is really happening with Chartres, the Chartres Labyrinth, is of the same kind. It's, you know, the Chartres Labyrinth is said by the church and everybody else to be only about the fact that this labyrinth should be used as a way of preaching, and the way of preaching is very limited to the Catholic faith. And so no matter what evidence you present, the scientists or the church officials saying your interpretation of what the labyrinth is at best too small in scope, and at worst a lie, they will not go away from that position. They will maintain this. So anyway, back to Bucharest. You know, the mayor there is very much at the forefront of so many campaigns. And I think if the mayor of Montsegur could join his crusade, he would probably do so. Ranochateau is a completely different bailiwick, because that village pretty much survives on esoterica and people coming there for the mystery. But definitely the mayor of Bucharest is one person who has gotten to the pages of the New York Times, the various various British newspapers, and also you know, Dutch magazines, Belgian newspapers, all of that are reporting on the fact that somehow there are dozens, hundreds, maybe thousands of people heading to Bucharest in time for December 21st, 2012. And we know people who live in Bucharest, actually quite a few, and they say that, you know, the only people they have seen come to their village are photographers and newspaper reporters and sometimes camera teams who are reporting on this, but that actually in reality nobody is coming to that village. People who come to that village come there to admire some of the local scenery. It's a beautiful hill. They obviously want to do certain things in the surrounding area, but nothing to do with the 2012 phenomenon. And so what we have there is really very interesting, that you have an elected official who basically decides that he is going to become you know, the promoter of a craze which really isn't happening at all in practice. And I think it's very interesting to see that this is still happening in the early 21st century, that this is something which is still so much at the forefront, and very much that what you would think of as a progressive country as France is completely at odds in trying to work out what to do with all of these things. And it's a very interesting thing to see, because we take groups, and we are about to head back to France in a number of weeks and take four groups through the beauty that is southern France and show them the mysteries of Catharism, of the, you know, the footprints of Mary Magdalene and the Book of Love, and that France as a whole, and I would say the entire world as a whole, but France as a whole has this very unique position. The French always say that, you know, the Church of France is closest to the Vatican, and to a large extent it is, because you know, one of the first Christian preachers all was occurring in France. There are Christian saints going back to the 3rd century AD, very early people being converted there. And of course one of the principal reasons is that Mary Magdalene and a few other people like Lazarus, Martha, after what happened in, you know, 33 AD or whatever you want to label the year as to when Jesus died on the cross, basically what happened shortly afterwards is that they left the Holy Land and came to France in the hope that there was refuge to be found there, and to a large extent it was. But they began to convert and preach in the south of France, and basically brought about an early form of Christianity, and a form of Christianity which has pretty much always survived underground in France. And so that is what we are trying to show on these strips, that there is this, you know, mystery to be found, and sometimes that clues to this are really very much in your face, that you don't have to look too far to see this heresy in full swing. And obviously we all know about the mystery of Ranochateau, but you know, just so much of that mystery really has been misinterpreted or has been made out into a direction where I think it shouldn't really be taken. It's the fact that, you know, the church doesn't really say anything bad about Mary Magdalene anymore. They are very much open and willing to tell you that the bones of Mary Magdalene are in St. Baume, St. Maximum, and Vézelay, and they are there on display. You can go and visit them. We're going to go to St. Baume and St. Maximum in May with a group, and everybody in the party will see the bones of Mary Magdalene there. You know, I was one of the highlights definitely of 2011 was when the bones of Mary Magdalene, who are normally in St. Baume, went on a tour of Southern California, and I was, by complete coincidence, if there's such a thing, carrying the bones of Mary Magdalene, the relic of St. Baume, from a church stand into a waiting car to be dashed off to another church where it was going to be put on public display. And, you know, carrying the bones of Mary Magdalene when you have written about her, when you are married to Kathleen, who has written about it, is definitely a very, you know, rich moment, but also a very humble moment and a very special moment. And it's, to me, you know, I, even though I have the reputation of being a skeptic by the believers and a believer by the skeptic, by and large, I am still a person who is part and parcel of the, what I would say, the esoteric or the alternative landscape. And unfortunately, that is quite often clouded and shown or interpreted as something which is weird. You know, somehow history is supposed to be rewritten, and that is true. But history doesn't have to be rewritten too much. And so when I see books who basically say that the tomb of Mary Magdalene is located in or near Rennes-le-Château, or claims to that effect, you know, it really makes my blood boil, because it's so weird to see that. Because here's the thing, you know, again, the bones of Mary Magdalene are known. They are in Vézelay, St. Baume, and St. Maximin, and that tells you enough. The church isn't lying about the fact that she was in France. You know, her bones aren't underneath the Louvre. You know, the Da Vinci Code is a piece of fiction. But getting that into the public consciousness, that this alternative point of view of history is interesting, but that you shouldn't take it too literally, that you don't have to invent a new layer. You basically, you know, you have the official line, which is that basically the church doesn't care about Mary Magdalene, and that, you know, what the alternative view is that Mary Magdalene is an important saint, the first, you know, person to basically preach the faith of her husband, the message of her husband, I should probably better say, and that she did so in France. And the church doesn't deny that. The church just doesn't underline it. And, you know, to some extent you could say that the Catholic Church is a Christian church, and, you know, it should therefore all be about Jesus Christ, and so who cares about Mary Magdalene? And to some extent, you know, I could go along with that. But the fact that then the other alternative views are so extreme and make it so weird. You know, Mary Magdalene would be the last who would care about her own bones and where they were buried. For her, it would be all about the message. And that is a true spirit of Catharism. Mary Magdalene was a very important person within Catharism of southern France. And it was because not only had she preached there, but also because the people of Catharism remembered her tradition, remembered her words, remembered her message, rather than adhering to what Christianity had become through a number of centuries. The Catharism of that region was very close to Mary Magdalene. And so, you know, what you have there in the south of France, in places like Rennes-le-Château, Bucharest, Montségur, is really this Cathar idea living there. But at the same time, you see it being misinterpreted by so many people. Definitely in Montségur, there is way too much emphasis on the role of a 1930-ish guy called SS Obersturmführer Otto Rahn. He basically was a Nazi who came to that region in search of the Holy Grail. You know, fell in love with some of the stories and wrote two books before he himself fell foul of some people in the Nazi chain of command and for, you know, probably to do with the fact that he was gay, and obviously gays were one of the people, or the groups rather, who the Nazis tried to exterminate, and so he died in a concentration camp. Now, you know, here we are. We have this guy who did just that, but again, so many myths are being spun around him. And the truth of the matter is that the true beauty of these places is so rich. And it's with a sad heart that I see this happening again in 2012. We see so many things of fear and doom. And Duncan and I were talking over the last few days about how, you know, basically Nexus Magazine, it's the official title is Nexus New Times. And everybody in the conspiracy crowd has quite often got this idea that we are being dominated and that we are suppressed and that we have to break free. And Duncan and I were relating, you know, stories about how there is also a different side to this, that there are conspiracy theories who basically say that there are people out there in government who are trying to get us to a different level of understanding, who are, you know, trying to bring out the good in us, who are trying to change us for the better. And even though this is in theory a conspiracy, because, you know, it is done behind the scenes, and to a large extent maybe we don't want to evolve, maybe we do like to watch the Kardashians and nothing but the Kardashians and no episodes of Ancient Aliens or anything else like that, but that is very much, you know, another side of the conspiracy coin, and too few people are focusing on that. People tend to hang on to the negative, and this is quite often the case. The pendulum has swung very far, and in other debates to do with the Divine Feminine, you get to see debates whereby quite often in those groups men are being treated as second-class citizens, that somehow men seem to be in need of extermination, that every single man is an enemy of the Divine Feminine. And that is something which is definitely, you know, something which is very dangerous, and I think something which is very sad. I always say that men are as much a victim of what happened as women are. Men in this day and age are, you know, to some extent slaves of the system as well. Men are required quite often to wear an office environment ties, and it literally cuts the oxygen out of you, and it is this kind of tie, literally, which stops heart and mind connecting, breaking the two up and depriving the heart quite often, because so much in business is done without the heart. And you know, men are basically visibly the symbol of this, but they, you know, I don't think there is any man who would say, you know, if you can go into an office without a tie or with a tie, what would you prefer? Pretty much everybody would opt for the no tie option. And that is something which is something, you know, which is done by a system. It is something which society has dictated, has become to dictate. And society is larger than just any individual or just the man alone. It is something which is this group consciousness, which is, you know, manipulated and sometimes guided and sometimes created on its own. But men and women are part of that mindset, and so we live in a society today where it's true that women are finding their need to find their new place, and that generations of women are redefining the role of something which they haven't been able to do for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. But the same is true for men. Men are, you know, redefining themselves as well, and need to redefine themselves as well in this global village in which we are all living. So that is, to some extent, what kind of like is really the underlying message. We see an awful lot of people dashing around the place, dashing around Europe, resettling themselves in different countries. Our good friends Stephen and Barbara just left, you know, basically Germany behind, where they lived for many years, to settle in the south of France and they too are heeding this call. And this is pretty much what I see everywhere of people stepping into new shoes, or at least testing the new shoes and see how they fit, and trying out new things. And that is definitely a great thing. And I hope that if you are, have the opportunity or feel challenged to step into those new shoes, then by all accounts do so. If it is meant to be, you will have a great life. And heed that call and step into your mission and do what you really feel you are out there to do. We are taking groups. Again, last year we did 3 Sacred Friends groups. This year we're doing 4. And in that case, it is just a week of people traveling around into this countryside and us explaining to them whether it's the mystery of the Cathars or the role of Mary Magdalene or the history of the Book of Love. But in each case, it's a step outside of a comfort zone. Even if you have traveled on numerous occasions, even if you've seen much of the world, the way the south of France is—it's different. It's special, and it's one of those trips. I would definitely rank it up there with visits to Egypt, Peru, Mexico. It really is out there, and I think it's a great region to find yourself. And to a large extent, that is also why there are so many popular books about the Provence, or to some extent even the Da Vinci Code. There is this appeal of France, of finding true inspiration there, and that is definitely something which we try to show these people. But other people just come to their on their own by themselves, and have been doing so for decades. So we have been traveling, and we are looking for beautiful places. And one of the beautiful places we have fallen in love with in recent years is actually Mont Saint-Michel. This place, one of the big tourist attractions after Paris. It is one of the most famous tourist attractions in the south. In France. And we were there for Kathleen's birthday, and unfortunately, for the people who were with us, there was a nationwide strike of the National Monuments of France. The Abbey of Mont Saint-Michel is part of this. And as a result of this, various national monuments were closed, and so the Abbey on the 2 days when we were in Mont Saint-Michel was closed, and we couldn't get in. But this is a stunning location, a beautiful place, stunning scenery. I hadn't been to Mont Saint-Michel until April of last year, and then both Kathleen and I fell absolutely in love with it, and we have been back twice since and are making plans to go back there at some point in the future, because it is truly beautiful. It is a truly magical place. We have spoken about the role of Michael, and we will continue to do so. But it's obviously linked with the role of Michael. But the other place where we have rapidly fallen in love with again is the region of Carnac, where there are these hundreds, thousands of megaliths in enormous configurations. I have been there since 1997, and just on this last trip, on the very last morning, we came across an annex field and of a megalithic complex in Erdeven, and basically found even more megaliths which I hadn't seen before. And these are massive. These are 18, 20 feet high standing stones weighing hundreds of thousands. Not hundreds of thousands, but several tons. The case of the Grand Man here, which was 60 feet high and lives in Loch Maria Care, that one actually weighed 300 tons when it was erected. And it has since fallen. But so many of these standing stones there are so gigantic, and this is something which was a tremendous project. This is something which is truly a lost civilization about which we know very little. And I wouldn't say an oath, but I definitely swore to myself that and this was in the early 1990s, that I would put megaliths back on the map. And for those of you who know, I have published a piece in an anthology of Lost Civilizations, and the book was published in December of last year, with various contributions from the likes of Eric von Däniken and various other people. And I have a piece there on the megalithic civilization and how it is linked with Atlantis. And for people who want to have details about it, I can definitely, say get that book. It's in my opinion a good read and a good anthology. But it's one of those places. Karnak is one of those places where you just get confronted with the scale of it all, and you really wonder what our ancestors were up against and were all about, because what they were doing there just defies belief. The amount of man hours which has gone into that, the amount of detail I've reported on the work of Howard Crowhurst in May of last year on an episode of The Spirit Revolution, and how basically the entire field of Karnak has been designed with advanced mathematics, and how every stone was carefully positioned according to mathematical astronomical information. And this is something which is only slowly coming out to the surface and into consciousness, but it is definitely something which is extremely important, because it just shows you the extent and the level of detail which went into the Karnak megalithic alignments. Is something which truly defies belief. You have to be there to see it, and then when you see it, you still don't believe the extent, the massive scale in which thousands of megaliths were put there, very precise alignments, and just places like Krukshuna, where you have a 40-ton dolmen. It's like gigantic stone resting on a few blocks, and the way it rests on these blocks is almost done by magic. You just can't believe they managed to do so, but somehow they did. And nothing of it is accidental. Everything is carefully planned, because otherwise it would literally be a house of cards. It would all collapse to the ground. And to see that on this scale is truly astonishing. And as I said, Kathleen and I have also gone there 3 times in the last year and have completely fallen in love with that region, and will definitely be heading back there. And, we are, as I said earlier, we are blessed to be able to explore these places, but it is just part of a larger whole. And spending time with Duncan and some other people, it is clear that everybody across the world is finding special places. Everybody across the world, as we approach December 21st, 2012, I think is also beginning to reinterpret history, reinterpret where we came from. And I hope that is the true message of the Spirit Revolution. My slogan on my website is "Ancient knowledge will give us a future," and I really do believe and to some extent pray that is true. That really our ancestors, had all of this information, had all of this knowledge, and that us appreciating the fact that there were before us people who had this knowledge was extraordinary. And again, Duncan and I, we were talking about Gavin Menzies, who we interviewed a few weeks, maybe now a few months ago, and he is the author of a number of books, including 1421, 1434, and The Lost Civilization of Atlantis. And specifically the first two books, Gavin goes into lots of detail about how the Chinese really had this extraordinary amount of knowledge, and in 1421 and in 1434 sailed out across the world, and pretty much what they did when they arrived in Europe was they went to the heads of state and said, here is all the information you need, information about astronomy, information about geology, information about this, information about that, and they basically handed out all the information to the world. And it is remarkable that it takes a person like Gavin Menzies in, I think early 21st century to bring this out into the open again and highlight the fact that this was happening. And this is, something truly extraordinary, but also something truly beautiful. This mindset of an emperor who basically sends out ships across the world and says to the people of the world, here is knowledge for free. take with it and do with it what you want. And obviously he must have had a conviction that it was going to be used for good, and that is to a large extent what happened. The Renaissance was a result of this. And so Duncan and I were talking about how, you know, we live in these times of cover-up, how politicians definitely try to cover things up rather than exposing them, and that is happening everywhere, you know, every political campaign, and there are so many political campaigns going on, whether it is Sarkozy for re-election in France, obviously the antics of Putin in Russia, the Obama versus whoever is going to run against him in America. All of these things are dominating 2012, and they're very interesting to see, you know, being developed. To find that Putin is back into power is definitely something I think, you know, we weren't expecting a few years ago, but he's back with a vengeance, and more powerful than maybe ever. And so to see this happening and to see these and to live in this atmosphere of cover-up, but also to some extent perceived conspiracy cover-up, and you know, the notions of disclosure, the hope that we are going to be told the truth about UFOs and what the American government knows about this and that, it's to a large extent idle hope. You know, we, Duncan and I definitely are of an opinion that it takes a larger person than the people currently in charge of this world for that to happen. You know, there are spots across the world of hope whereby we hope that this message of hope really comes out, and that this message of openness will come about, just like the Chinese emperors of 1421 and 1434, who felt that knowledge was always good and truth should be disseminated and known to all. And, you know, truth conquers all, just like love does. And that is something I think which is an interesting thing to go forward with. Like, are there people out there in the world who are willing to embrace truth and are willing to tackle the current climate, and we will see whether that is going to happen or not. And it's definitely something which, you know, that nobody has an answer for. But again, 2012 is a very interesting year because of what everything is happening. You know, Sarkozy is up for re-election, and we were in France when the entire saga happened about a Toulouse gunman, and I definitely have, you know, my suspicions about how we are once again fed a story which is so neat and so perfect and so useful for Sarkozy, that it quite often, you know, if it's too good to be true, it quite often isn't true. And that is definitely the case with the way this story is developing. And sure enough, you see once again, like, whether it is with the invasion of Iraq, or whatever, that people are rallying behind a president. However much they hate him, however much they do these things, in times like these, people rally behind their president. And that is definitely something which is happening in France. And Sarkozy is playing that card as we speak. And so that is something which, you know, I find extremely sad, that politicians and the people of worldly power continue to cling on to this, and in times when maybe new avenues should be explored. But you know, I'm not going to say too much more about this. But Duncan and I do feel that there is hope, that there is you know, however, how should I put this? That there is there a conspiracy? Yes. But what is the purpose behind the conspiracy? And so many people quite often always think, you know, the worst, because it's a conspiracy, it's done by powerful people. But then what we realized, and to some extent have known for a while, is that for good ideas to come about, quite often the same tools and things need to be in place. And so, you know, even though you see something as a conspiracy, jumping to the conclusion that it's by default bad is not necessarily something which is, you know, always shouldn't be the immediate conclusion to draw. Sometimes there's just evidence, and it's hard to interpret whether it's negative or positive. And simply because it looks like a conspiracy doesn't necessarily mean it's bad. And that is definitely something which we have been talking about in the last few days. And it's definitely something which I think and I hope is going to not just affect us, but other people as we begin to realize, I think, that we are truly humanized people, that we really have an awful lot of potential. One of the things which Catharism believed was that every one of us was a fully anthropos, a fully human being who could communicate with the gods, contact with the realm of the divine was something which everybody could do. And that is something which the church always has opposed and continue to oppose. They are really there to put themselves out as the middleman, the man where you have to go to in order to talk to God, and you have to do that. And that is something which is on its way out. And again, villages like Monsego, Rennes-le-Château, and so many other places are a great example of that. Now, speaking of Monsego, as last year in Monsego, we came across a beautiful voice, a beautiful artist, Devayani, and her family. We call it the Brenac family, because whenever Devayani plays, she is always surrounded by a group of loyal followers who basically have grown up with her. And Deva is a very special girl who quite often at a concert says, I've going to play a song to you. I have no idea where it's going. It's just coming to me, and I will do that. Which happens a lot when she feels the magic of that moment. And we were privileged to listen to a few of her concerts, and it made us once again appreciate how much we have been missing her divine music. And so we once again want to share with you some of her music, which you can hear in the south of France when she is playing there. But she is a very special person, and we want to leave you with this episode of The Spirit Revolution with a song which is Monsego, which she always uses as the final song of her concert, because for her Monsego is a very special place. For her it is a place where she has dreams of, a place which is very important to her and her family, and it is very important to for so many reasons. And in 2012, it continues to be a symbol of basically a truth which was safeguarded. And we were there in Monsego on March 16th, and it was in March 16th. 1244, that 220 people walked to their death. They were burned by the church for being heretics. And what everybody was focusing on was obviously the sadness, but also what happened on March 16th was that a few days before, a little girl fled from that mountain carrying the Book of Love into safety. And it is said that once she reached the people who she had to meet and who were going to take care of her and the book and the information she had with her, they lit a fire. And so on March 16th, 1244, the people who walked into the fire, who were going to be burned as heretics, they also knew that what they had stood for, what they had fought for so many years, for which they had been besieged for I believe a total of 9 months, would survive. They the truth always survives. And I think that is definitely something which I want to leave you with at the end of this episode of The Spirit Revolution, which is that the truth not only always survives, but also that the truth will always come out. And that is a big hope for the future. And what better way to end that with the beautiful rendition of Monsego of Devayani. Until the next time, from Kathleen and myself, the truth against the world.